Lowe v. McGraw-Hill. Ms. Albrecht.
May it please the court. My name is Catherine Albrecht and I represent the appellants and the cross-appellees, the McGraw-Hill. There are two appeals before the court today, McGraw-Hill's and George Lowe's. If it pleases the court, I will address Mr. Lowe's appeal because it presents the most unusual circumstances and it's the one with the greatest financial impact. That appeal involves two purported judgment orders in the case below. And as a practical matter, which one governs the case below is critical because the first one would afford Mr. Lowe 12 times as much as the district court ultimately awarded. Now, by way of timeline, Mr. Lowe filed a pro se complaint in January of 2001 in which he sought retirement benefits as the surviving spouse of his deceased wife. He brought it under ERISA. On April 24th of 2001, upon Mr. Lowe's motion, the district court entered an order finding
Wait, let me have it backwards. You have an appeal, and he has a cross appeal. Well, it's a cross appeal. Now, don't you want to argue your appeal and then respond to his cross appeal argument?
Your Honor, I think
it's backwards. Now, you have the appellee arguing first.
Well, Your Honor, that's an issue really in the designation of the appeals in this case as a practical matter. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Lowe filed his appeal first. He filed his appeal on April 2nd of 2003. He appealed a March 5th, 2003 order, which we separately contend is not a final order in any event and that the court doesn't have jurisdiction. The court, or the clerk's office, has designated McGraw-Hill's appeal as a cross appeal on its own initiative.
Do it as you want. I don't know why. I don't know what you worry. You really think that the cross appeal has any possible merit? I don't understand.
Well, Judge, I, with all due respect, I have to take it seriously. As I say, it does have a significant amount of financial appeal. We believe that under the circumstances of the case, Judge Conlon didn't abuse her discretion in vacating the order pursuant to Rule 68. The judgment order was entered on May 24th of 2001, and it was not entered on the docket.
Well, what sense is it a clerk? I thought you were arguing not on 68, but 60B6. What is clerical about the error? Who made the error?
Well, the error was in Judge Conlon's failure to reflect her intent at the time the May 24th order was entered. And we submit that that orders that don't reflect the judge's intent.
Well, how do you distinguish between a clerical error and a mistake?
Well, the clerical error reflects is simply a translational issue with respect to...
Scrivener's error?
Excuse me?
A scrivener's error?
It's not limited to scrivener's errors, Your Honor. In fact,
What's the difference between an error and a mistake?
Pardon me?
What's the difference between an error and a mistake, which I think was what you said?
Well, it's really a legal distinction, actually. They're both in some respects...
I've been in the law business for a few years, and I'm still trying to educate me.
Well, Rule 68 and Rule 60B1, which I believe is what Your Honors may be referring to, the distinction does make a difference here. Under Rule 60A, a mistake under Rule 60A is an issue as to whether or not the court's order reflects its intention. Its intention when the order was entered. The technical issue here is when the order was entered. And Mr. Lowe disputes Judge Conlon's order on Rule 60A because he said the order reflected her intent when she entered it. But the fact of the matter is, she signed Mr. Lowe's proposed order on May 24th of 2001, but that order wasn't entered on the official docket until June 5th of 2001. And Rule 58 makes clear that that a judgment isn't effective until it's not final, until it's entered on the docket. And this order was entered on the docket on June 5th of 2001, but that was one day later than the district court clearly evidenced her intent.
Okay, so that's my question. So who made the error?
It was Judge Collins there, and as Judge Collins...
Did she do the docketing? So she issued this default order, right? And then later she issues an inconsistent order. Then the default order is docketed as a judgment. Is that what happened?
That's correct.
Okay, so who made the mistake? Who docketed it as a judgment?
Well, the record reflects, Your Honor, that on June 4th, the court denied me going
home. I know. What happened on June 5th?
On June 5th, the court docketed.
Who is the court? Who does the docketing?
The clerk docketed, but Judge Conlon's chamber.
Are you saying that it's a clerk made a clerical error, right? That's what a clerical error is, a clerk's error.
What happens, and what's reflected in the record, Your Honor, is that this order was not received by the clerk's office until 5:45, nearly 6 p.m. on June 4th of 2001. It appears...
Ask me completely, who did the docketing?
The clerk's office did the docketing, but it appears, Your Honor, that Judge Conlon's office didn't send the order over to the clerk's office until after she had referred this matter to the magistrate judge.
The magistrate didn't send it over, or her internal...
It's not clear.
Oh.
But the fact remains that Judge Conlon has the power to modify a judgment before it's entered on the docket. And we submit that that's exactly what Judge Conlon did.
Now you've lost me completely. This May 24th or whatever it is, this should not have been docketed as a judgment, right? Because it's been superseded by the June 4th order.
Correct.
So who did the docketing?
Well, the clerk docketed on
the
docketing.
It was the clerk's error. And why is it that you're arguing against yourself? Since obviously a clerk's error is something a lot more like a clerical error than a judge's error.
I appreciate what you're saying, Your Honor, but the question and the reason I'm focusing on it is because the case law, and in particular United States versus Griffin, this court's opinion, says that the Rule 68 isn't limited to clerical errors.
It's captioned clerical errors. Anyway, you've got this. Why aren't you arguing 60B? I don't want to make your argument for you, but look, this is obviously an absurdity, right? It's an absurdity for him to be claiming these damages, which obviously the judge never intended to give him. So we have 60B6, which is a catch-all, and we can use it to deal with absurdities, can't we? And I thought that's what you argued in your brief.
That is what we argued in our brief. Judge Conlon decided the issue under Rule 60A, and we simply were beginning the argument by saying that she didn't abuse her discretion. The court certainly has the power to affirm on any basis evident in the record, and we do believe that 60B6 covers this situation. In particular, Rule 60B6 permits this court to be modify orders whenever appropriate to accomplish justice, and the only restriction on the timing of a motion for relief under Rule 60B6 is a reasonable time period. And here, McGraw-Hill moved to vacate the order within a week of finding out about it.
Are you going to say anything about your own appeal, or are you going to just let us read your brief?
Judge, we certainly do rely on arguments that we make in our briefs. I would be happy to address that aspect. Given the limited amount of time this morning, we chose instead to focus on the issue of the most consequence, at least in terms of financial impact.
Well, I don't see anything in your brief on your main appeal is really addressed to an appellate court. I mean, you can say to the judge, you know, we screwed around and we had back office problems and so on, and please be merciful, which Judge Conlon was not. I don't see how we get into it. It's obviously a judgment here. You've got a big company. You didn't deal properly with this person. Now you say it was because you had messy files and you'd acquired a company and so on. Why isn't that an archetypal discretionary question for the judge to decide?
Well, briefly, Your Honor, the primary issue is because Judge Conlon, in adopting the magistrate's order and issuing her opinion, determined that McGraw-Hill knew in July 1999 that Mr. Lowe had not waived his pension benefits.
Well, he certainly didn't have the notarization, which was required for the waiver.
That
certainly should have put you on notice that you know, probably there was no waiver.
Well, except for the fact that there were unusual circumstances, we believe.
So unusual circumstances, something you should have investigated. You're a big company. You don't just say, oh, unusual circumstances, so we'll let this fellow stew till he gets a lawyer. That's not dealing fairly with someone to whom you have fiduciary obligations.
Your Honor, I understand what your point is. On the other hand, we believe that under the circumstances that were presented,
I don't care what the circumstances are. You've made an acquisition. Your files are all screwed up. You see something with a missing notarization, and you don't do anything about it.
The fact of the matter is, we ultimately did pay the pension.
Ultimately, yes, after you get the lawyer and so on. But meanwhile, you've put him through a lot of hoops. You've precipitated his suit and his appeal and so on. I don't know. It seems to me that's for the district judge to decide whether you ought to be punished for your incompetence. Okay, thanks. Your time has expired. Mr. Haney?
May it please the court and counsel, Mr. Lowe. Your Honors, I'm Robert Haney. I represent George Lowe. And I welcome the opportunity to start with my appeal, unless Your Honors want me
to go ahead.
Away.
Walk into the
why don't you get right into it in explaining that, you know, how you respond to McGraw's argument that between May 4th, 2001 and June 5th, the district court's intent to award the default damages had changed.
Well, I don't know about what the judge's intent was. I think the best way to find out is
Well, we certainly know what the judge's intent was. You have no right to this additional money.
I think the thing to do is to look at the two orders that were drafted by the judge to determine what her intent was.
Oh, please. She's made quite clear what her intent was.
Well,
her intent was not to award your client money to which he has absolutely no entitlement.
I believe that her intent was absolutely to give him all of the relief that was on the four corners.
There obviously was a mistake. There was a screw-up here.
I absolutely agree there was a mistake. The mistake was what the judge said the mistake was in failing to vacate the order that she signed on May 24th of 01. That mistake falls under Rule 60B1.
No, it doesn't.
Well, I do, Your Honor, I think that if you...
No, it doesn't, because, look, ask yourself, why is there a one-year deadline in 60B1? Have you ever thought about that?
Well, I believe there should be no requirement.
Why do you think there's a one-year deadline in 60B1?
I answer it by looking at 60A. It makes sense to me there not be any type of a jurisdictional time limit, because if the order doesn't capture the entire...
Why do you think there's a one-year deadline in 60B1?
Because there has to, because of the policy of finality and
enforcement in 60B6 and other subdivisions.
Right.
What is special about 60B1?
Because the court requires the attorneys to follow their case. And if there's a mistake...
No, I think you're wrong. I think the reason for the one-year deadline is that parties are entitled to rely on judgments. So the fact that it was a mistake doesn't mean you can yank the judgment out years later. But you didn't rely here. There's no reliance.
Well, it doesn't make any difference, Your Honor.
Oh, it does make a difference. It does make a difference, because this is a complete windfall that you're seeking, and you don't have a reliance interest, and I don't think the policy of 60B1 is engaged. It's either 60A or 60B6.
Well, respectfully, I don't see that there's a windfall when Mr.
Well, you're entitled to this money, number one. Number two, you have never relied on his mistake except to file a silly cross appeal.
Well, again, respectfully, I don't see how my reliance or my understanding has to do with whether the court is going to...
Well, the judiciary would be a laughing stock if this set of circumstances entitled your client to money.
No. I think, respectfully, it's the converse. I think if Seventh Circuit jurisprudence and if justice means anything, it means that the rules have to be followed and they have to be applied equally.
They don't have to be interpreted. The rules have to be interpreted.
Correct.
And deciding whether something is a mistake or a clerical error or falls under the catch-all, we look at the purpose of these provisions, and in particular, why it is that for some provisions there's a one-year limit and others there aren't.
Right.
And I think the purpose of the one-year limit is to protect reliance, and I don't think Lowe ever relied on that May 24th or June 5th judgment.
Well, it is certainly true that everyone proceeded as if that order had not been entered, but that's the whole reason that we're here, Your Honor, because that order, to call that a 60A order, if
well, I'm going to call it a 60B6 order.
All right. Well, if you want to call it a 60B6 order, the problem you have is the Seventh Circuit decisions in Brandon and in Westco. In those cases, Your Honor is well aware that the court stated that 60B1 and 60B6 are mutually exclusive.
Sure. And 60B1 is for the type of mistake on which people rely. And 60B6, where there's no reliance, no possible conceivable argument for allowing a person to have the advantage of the judgment.
Well, I think it's important to note that Mr. Lowe was a pro se plaintiff. He followed exactly what it is the court asked him to do. He submitted a memorandum.
And he was compensated. He's been compensated with this, you know, $35,000 or whatever he was given.
But, Your Honor, I don't believe it is appropriate to fly in the face of the policy of enforceability and finality of orders by saying that because Mr. Lowe, a pro se plaintiff, didn't rely upon an order that he wasn't aware was entered, that now we're going to take that away on the grounds of Rule 60A, which this absolutely doesn't fit within Rule 60A.
I find that 60B6.
Well, again, 60B6, unfortunately, for McGraw-Hill's attorneys, is not available to them.
Well, it is. I think it is.
Because of 60B1. Well,
I don't agree with you.
That is my argument on Mr. Lowe's appeal. The only other point I would make is that, again, there are some specific relief that's awarded to him in that order that obviously if an attorney had written the order, it might have been written differently, but there is every indication that that order was indicated to be a judgment because that's what the judge said it was, a final judgment order. And the fact that no punitive damages were awarded is presumably because the judge was aware that punitive damages were not available under ERISA, so that there is nothing about the order, putting aside the other arguments, Your Honor, about 60B1, there's nothing in the order that makes it not a final judgment and not final. Unless you have other questions about Mr. Lowe's appeal, then I'll talk briefly about McGraw-Hill's appeal. And McGraw-Hill's appeal raises two simple issues, both of which are abuse of discretion standard. Number one, the award of statutory penalties, and number two, the award of attorney's fees and costs. And the penalties that were awarded were $50 a day calculated from the date that McGraw-Hill received a specific request for the plan until the date that the plan was finally delivered. The amount of money awarded is supported by case law, specifically the Nuwema case, which is a Northern District, Illinois case, and the Hess case.
Let me ask you this. How do we know that Conlon would have imposed the same fees and penalties if she hadn't mistakenly believed you had discussed the two different forms in your letters?
Well, the district court judge adopted the report and recommendation of the magistrate in full, and part of what the magistrate found was that the McGraw-Hill representative testified at trial that at the time Mr. Hill was making a request for documents that they were aware that he had not effectively waived his rights to those benefits. Therefore, he was a beneficiary. There was a fiduciary relationship, and they had every obligation to give him the documents he was requesting. By adopting, you know, in full, Judge Conlon was obviously aware that this is a case not only where there was bad faith, but where, when given an opportunity at trial to explain the situation, McGraw-Hill representatives had no plausible explanation for having put Mr. Lowe through what they put him through. So there's ample evidence from the hearing, from the trial, to support the award of statutory penalties. Mr. Lowe was obviously the prevailing party, and the court had jurisdiction to award fees and costs, which is what they did.
Well, OK.
Okay, thank you very much.
Unless you have other questions.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And your time, has your time expired? Okay, well, we thank both counsel. Next case for argument, Steinman versus...